Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter and Phil Dierking. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, two United States government studies of cell phone radiation have found a weak link to an increased risk of cancer in animals. But government officials and scientists are telling cell phone users not to worry. They say it is safe to use your mobile device. Earlier studies of cell phone users had found little reason for concern. The latest research took a close look at the effects of very high radiation levels in animals to answer some questions that could not be tested on human subjects. In one study, researchers left cell phones in an area with rats. The researchers say radiation from the devices may have been responsible for a small increase in an unusual form of heart tumor in male rats. Yet there were no big problems in female rats or in a separate study of mice. The Associated Press says the scientist could not find strong evidence for concern about brain tumors. John Booker is with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. He was the lead writer of the report on the study. He told the AP he is not changing his cell phone use or asking his family to. Otis Browley is the American Cancer Society's chief medical officer. After reading the studies, he said, "I am actually holding my cell phone up to my ear." The rat and mice studies are not the same as real-life cell phone use, he noted. John Booker said the findings of the rare nerve tissue tumor found in the hearts of male rats does not mean humans should be worried. His agency carried out a $25 million study for the Food and Drug Administration, which quickly said cell phones are safe. Booker said average cell phone use is very, very, very much lower than what we studied. He told reporters the rats and mice were exposed to the radiation for 9 hours a day and for a period of up to 2 years. The radiation levels were so high that humans would only experience it for a short time. He said, at best, it might be a weak carcinogen, if in fact it is a carcinogen. For some unknown reason, the rats exposed to the radiation lived longer than the non-radiated rats. Booker said that could be just chance, or it could be that the radiation reduced the risk of a rat disease. The program released early test results 2 years ago. The earlier report showed a small risk of increased brain tumors in male rats. However, the final results were unable to confirm that. The new rat study found evidence for increases in damage to DNA, brain tumors, and a few other cancers, but it was not clear that it was related to the cell phones. Evidence of DNA damage was seen in some tissues of some animals, Booker said. He added that he didn't have the evidence to comment on its biological importance. Still, it was surprising that the animals did experience other effects, even if they were not at high enough levels to be important, said Lika Kaifitz. She is an epidemiology professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. She is also the former head of radiation studies for the World Health Organization. There is some concern that there is so much activity going on, she said. But it's not like the sky is falling, a huge effect. The findings failed to satisfy those concerned about cell phone radiation, like David Carpenter. He is the head of environmental health at the State University of New York in Albany. He said the studies were not large enough to uncover some rare problems and that the findings about brain tumors cannot be dismissed. It's not anywhere near as dangerous as cigarettes, Carpenter said, but he added that there is a real danger from continual use of a cell phone. In 2011, a working group of the International Agency for Research on Cancer said cell phones could possibly cause cancer. But many studies over the years have found little evidence of a problem.
Bats are the only mammals that can fly a great distance, but they have another ability. Many bats live a very long time for an animal their size. European researchers are studying bats to understand why they live so long. They hope to make discoveries aimed at fighting the aging process in human beings. Last week, the group of scientists said they had identified important biological qualities in some bat species. The group studied bat chromosomes, a line of genes found in the nucleus of cells. The scientists were most interested in structures connected to the ends of the chromosomes. They are called telomeres. Telomeres protect the ends of the chromosomes, which shorten each time a cell divides. Scientists believe this shortening process causes cells to break down. They say this is what causes aging. A report on bats was published this month in the journal Science Advances. Among the leaders of the study was Emma Teeling, a biologist with University College Dublin in Ireland. Teeling said studying long-living mammals that have developed ways to fight aging is an alternative way to identify the molecular basis of extended health spans. She added that studying bats enables scientists to learn more about the processes that drive healthy aging. The European researchers studied 493 bats from four bat species. The group used information that had been gathered over more than 60 years. Of these animals, the greater mouse-eared bat generally lived the longest, an average of 37 years. The scientists said this and a related species, which are grouped together under the name meiotis, had telomeres that did not shorten with age. Another meiotis bat holds the record for oldest age, reaching 41 years. The scientists' findings suggest that these bats' cells have the ability to maintain and repair their telomeres. This, they said, helps guard against the aging process. Based on its body size, a bat like the greater mouse-eared bat would be expected to live 4 years. But these mammals have been found to live nearly 10 times longer than that. The scientists found that only 19 species of mammals live longer than humans when their body size is considered. 18 of these are bats. I'm Mario Ritter.
Mosquito nets usually are used to prevent the spread of diseases, which are passed by mosquito bites. Those treated with insect-killing substances have been especially successful in the fight against malaria. But nets now are being used for catching fish in many tropical areas, a new study says. The net's effectiveness is worrying some experts about possible harm to fish populations. The study was published by the free online journal PLOS ONE. The study's writers say poverty is the main reason for mosquito net fishing. They say efforts to limit use of the method might hurt people who live on the edge of survival. Insecticide-treated mosquito nets are used to cover the place in which a person sleeps to prevent mosquitoes from biting them. The nets are provided widely, often at low cost or even free. The World Health Organization says access to the nets helped reduce a drop in malaria deaths. The WHO found a 60% reduction from 2000 to 2015. More than 150 million nets were given to countries where malaria exists in 2015. Rebecca Short is the lead investigator of the new research. She is studying for her doctorate in the ocean resources field at Imperial College London. Short is based in Mozambique. She says she sees many people there using insecticide-treated nets to fish. Fishing this way is easy and low cost, but this could result in higher numbers of fishermen and decreasing numbers of an already limited supply of fish. Short and her co-workers did a small online study to learn about the size of the issue. They gave the survey to conservation, health, and development workers worldwide. Nearly 100 people, from Senegal to Samoa, reported seeing mosquito net fishing. "I don't think even we expected to get the results that we did," Short says. "Pretty much everywhere that malaria's a risk, there's people fishing with these nets. Some of the time, the fishing was simple and would just involve a couple people dragging a net through the water," Short says. She said the small-scale net fishing can provide a good source of protein and money without serious problems. She also said this can be good for women who are often prevented from doing more profitable work. However, the researchers found wider and more damaging use of mosquito nets elsewhere. The study describes cases, as in Bangladesh, where fishermen blocked entire river spans with mosquito nets. In these cases, Short says, obviously, absolutely nothing gets through. Fishing with mosquito nets is illegal in many places to keep the fish population safe. But Short is not sure that is the best way to control the method. There's huge issues with enforcement, she says. Do you put a mother who's trying to feed her kids in prison for 3 years just for using a mosquito net to fish with? Tim McClanahan is a reef scientist with the Wildlife Conservation Society. He has questioned the benefits mosquito net fishers are reportedly gaining. He says many people believe that because the poor and women are doing it, it is improving their food security. However, his research has found that is not always true. Fishery management methods include catching larger, full-grown fish that have had time to produce children. But Rebecca Short's study discusses a debated method called balanced harvest. In this method, fishers try to catch fish of all sizes based on the numbers in their population. Since mosquito nets catch everything, the authors note, they may be helping. I'm Phil Dierking.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Throughout most of the 1850s, war was a continual threat between the North and the South over the issue of slavery. Then, in the autumn of 1859, the crisis seemed to calm. Anti-slavery extremists governed only a few states of the North, and pro-slavery extremists held power in only a few states of the Deep South. There had been elections in most of the northern and southern states. Voters had rejected candidates with extremist ideas and elected moderates instead. The public saw the elections as a sign of hope that reasonable people might find a way to settle the bitter dispute over slavery. But these hopes fell apart on October 17th, 1859. That day brought the news that a group of abolitionists had attacked the town of Harper's Ferry. The town was then part of Virginia. Today, it is part of West Virginia. Now, Jack Moyles and Harry Monroe continue our story.
The attack was led by John Brown, an old anti-slavery extremist. Many believed him insane. He had gone to Kansas and fought bitterly against pro-slavery forces. Once, to answer an attack on the town of Lawrence, Brown and his men pulled 5 men and boys from their homes and murdered them. The wife of one of the men said Brown told her, "If a man stands between me and what I believe to be right, I will take his life as coolly as I would eat my breakfast." Brown lost a son in a pro-slavery attack on his home at Osawatomie, Kansas. Brown and his friends were forced to flee. They watched as the pro-slavery men burned the town. Brown shook with grief and anger. "I have only a short time to live," he said, "only one death to die, and I will die fighting for this cause. There will be no more peace in this land until slavery is done for. I will give them something else to do than to extend slave territory. I will carry this war into the South.
To fight a war against Brown needed money and guns. He went to Massachusetts and New York. He spoke at town meetings and met privately with abolitionist leaders. In these private talks, Brown said it was too late to settle the slave question through politics or any other peaceful way. He said the only answer was a slave rebellion. It would be bloody, Brown said, and this was terrible. But slavery itself was a terrible wrong, the same as murder. Only blood, he said, would wash away the wrongs of slavery. Brown said God meant for him to begin this rebellion by invading Virginia with a military force he already was organizing. Brown said even if the rebellion failed, it would probably lead to a civil war between North and South. In such a war, he said, the North would break the chains of the black man on the battlefield.
Brown won the support of a group of abolitionist leaders. They formed a secret committee and called themselves the Secret Six. They agreed to advise Brown and, more importantly, to raise $1,000 for him. From New England, Brown went to Chatham, Canada. He went there for a secret convention he had called to form a revolutionary government. This government would rule all the slave territory that Brown and his men could capture. 46 representatives went to the convention, 34 Negroes and 12 whites. Brown told them of his plan. He said he was sure that Southern slaves were ready for rebellion. He said they would rise up at the first sign of a leader who wished to break their chains.
But what if troops are brought against you? One man asked. Brown answered that his men would fight in the mountains, where a small force could stop a much larger one. He said his men would be well trained in mountain fighting. Brown said he expected his small force to grow much larger. He would invite the slaves he freed to join his army. And he said he thought that all the free Negroes of the North would come to fight slavery with him. The representatives approved Brown's constitution, and they named him commander-in-chief.
Brown had decided to strike at Harper's Ferry, a town of about 2,500 people. It was in Northern Virginia, about 100 kilometers north of Washington. Harper's Ferry was built on a narrow finger of land where the Shenandoah River flowed into the Potomac River. There were two bridges. One crossed the Shenandoah. The other, a railroad bridge, crossed the Potomac to Maryland. John Brown chose Harper's Ferry because there was a factory there that made guns for the army. There also was an arsenal where several $1 million worth of military equipment was kept. Brown needed the guns and equipment for the slave army he hoped to form.
Old Brown arrived at Harper's Ferry early in July 1859. Two of his sons, Owen and Oliver, and another man came with him. They rented an old house on a farm in Maryland, not far from Harper's Ferry. Brown told people that he was a cattle buyer from New York. Brown's men joined him, one or two at a time, over the next several months. They traveled at night so no one would see them. Once they reached the farmhouse, they had to stay in hiding. Week by week, the little force grew. But it grew too slowly. By the end of summer, there were still less than 20 men hiding in the old house. Brown wrote letters to his supporters in the north. He asked for more money and more men. He got little of either. His supporters were afraid. Too many people knew of Brown's plans. The Secret Six feared they would face criminal charges if Brown attacked Harper's Ferry. Brown's men grew tired of the small, crowded rooms of the farmhouse. Brown knew he must act soon, or his young men would begin leaving.
On Saturday, October 15th, three men arrived to join the group. One of them brought $600 in gold for Brown's use. Brown saw the gold as a sign that God wanted him to act. He told his men they would strike the next night. Brown held religious services Sunday morning and prayed for God to help him free the slaves. Then he called his men around him to explain to them his battle plan. They would seize the two bridges at Harper's Ferry and close them. Next, they would capture the armory and the rifle factory. They would capture as many people as possible. They would use the people as hostages for protection against any soldiers that might be sent against them.
The army had no men near Harper's Ferry. Brown believed he would have all the time he needed. He believed his only opposition might be local groups of militia. He did not fear these civilian soldiers. The old man thought he and his men could hold Harper's Ferry until slaves in the area rebelled and joined them. Brown knew that Maryland and Western Virginia were full of people opposed to slavery. He expected many of them to come to his aid. The 22 men rested until dark, listening to rain hit the roof of the farmhouse.
About 8 o'clock, Brown called his group. "Men," he said, "get your weapons. We are going to the ferry." A wagon was brought out and a horse tied to it. In the wagon were a few tools and some extra guns. Brown climbed into the wagon and started it toward town. Two of his men stepped out in front of the wagon, leading the way. The others walked behind. It was a dark and cold night. A light rain was falling. There was no one else on the road. After a time, they reached the high ground above the Potomac. Below them, across the river, lay the town of Harper's Ferry. Most of the town was sleeping. Only a few lights shone through the rain. John Brown was ready for his final struggle against slavery.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.